A terrorist attack in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday killed nearly 300 people and injured more than 400. Some U.S. citizens were killed in those bombings, including Wisconsin native and UW alum Dieter Kowalski. While the Sri Lankan government is still piecing together what happened, it appears that it may have been a coordinated effort between locals and foreign terrorist groups. Our next guest is here to talk about the attacks this weekend and how the U.S. and other governments can reduce these violent incidents. Farah Pandith is a foreign policy strategist and former diplomat. She's currently an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and her new book is How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. Farah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, looking at this horrible series of attacks in Sri Lanka, one open question at this point seems to be how much was this done by locals in Sri Lanka versus international involvement? What do we know at this point?
Well, the information is still coming in, but the New York Times is obviously reporting that there are two possible local groups that have actually done the violence, but they were getting help from abroad. And this afternoon, we're getting reporting that ISIS has in fact said that they are taking responsibility for this, that their fighters are executing the behavior on their behalf. So, if this is true, then we're seeing a manifestation in Sri Lanka of. You know, the so-called Islamic State still taking the role, a very real role in events worldwide.
Have we seen anti-Christian targeted terrorism in Sri Lanka before?
There has been a wide array of different types of violence in Sri Lanka, but the essential point for everyone to be thinking about today and in the sobering days after this horrible Easter attack is that we're in a new phase of a worldwide phenomenon where various groups are taking aim at each other in different ways on different soil, you know, and what we should be really alert to the fact that ISIS, if true, ISIS claiming responsibility for this this horrible attack, saying it's in retaliation for what happened in Christchurch, is a new phase of this kind of extremism. And so I don't think one can look at past behaviors within countries or within regions suggesting that is an indication of what's to come. I think we're in a brand new era with new tools and digital natives who are connected to each other, responding to each other in real time.
Do you worry about a feedback loop where a group like ISIS points toward, as you say, an attack like in Christchurch, and then maybe a white nationalist group or an anti-Muslim group points toward these Sri Lanka attacks as a justification or to rally people for future attacks?
What I'm worried about is the call to action of an ideology of us versus them that is present all over the world. And different extremist groups are mobilizing around this ideology. And whoever the us is and whoever the them is may change in terms of what extremist group is actually taking this narrative and moving forward with it. The fact is that they're finding recruits. They're finding a way to advocate what they believe in and moving that towards violence. Violence, which is a very serious change in what we're dealing with today, because when we were looking at the ideological threat of groups like the so-called Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or Shabab or the Taliban, we had not actually included in that strategy, in fact, the rise of white supremacist movements as well, and the fact that there could, in fact, be a ping-ponging here where one group is doing one thing, one is retaliating for another. And I think we really need to be very conscious of this change and understand what could happen next.
That seems like it makes it very difficult to prevent this kind of terrorism if, regardless of where someone is in the world, they can point toward a manifesto from Norway, an ISIS video on YouTube as their motivation. That transcends national borders. How do you start to prevent that kind of inspiration and then attacks?
I think wringing hands and suggesting that there's no way out is not the answer. In fact, solutions are available and they are affordable right now. We have spent 20 years since 9/11 market testing various programs and initiatives in small ways, it is true, but it is time to scale what we know works to stop young people from finding the ideology of us versus them appealing. And those programs have been tested in an offline space and in an online space. And it is really outrageous that here we are in the days after this vile attack in Sri Lanka, still having the same kind of conversations we had after 9/11. This is too complicated. It's too hard. There's nothing we can do. In fact, there's a lot we can do right now. The solutions that I talk about are real. They have been, they can be deployed right this moment. What we don't have is leadership to make that happen.
We're talking to Farah Pandith about the attacks in Sri Lanka and about wider issues of preventing future terrorist attacks. Farah, have we had too much of a, the United States and other world governments, had too much of a reactive stance? We, after the last attack, try to figure out how to prevent exactly that same attack in the future.
Well, we've been lazy on hate, period. We are watching the rise of hate grow in various ways around the world, and everybody looks to the other as the entity that's going to deal with the problem. This is something government needs to do. This is something, you know, a faith group needs to do. This is something that, you know, pick your organization that should take this on. In fact, fighting hate requires all of us to go in, to take it seriously. It's a choice that we have to make. And what I have absolute belief in is that all this time post 9/11, where we have talked about this issue, I know that there is a way forward that requires us to come together and build the kind of machine 24/7 that is going to actually work on stopping recruitment of all kinds. And it is not something that is so challenging. What's challenging is the leadership and the kind of commitment that it's going to take from the private sector and from citizens themselves to say this is something we believe in.
Now, you talk about these issues in your new book, How We Win, and I'm hoping we'll have you back on to spend some more time on the book. But in general, now that the world is watching after the Christchurch attacks, after these attacks in Sri Lanka, how would we put into practice some of the things you are looking for to keep people from being recruited to these movements in the first place?
Well, the first thing to do, absolutely, is to say we're going to do something about it and actually take what we have learned in the last 20 years and scale it. We don't even have to build anything new. At this moment, we have market tested all kinds of programs that are available to us right now. The money that needs to come to actually allow them to scale can come from government, they can come from the private sector, and it can come from philanthropy. So if we do nothing else but scale what we already know is happening right now, we would be in a much better situation than we are.
Can you give us an example of one of those market-tested programs that might prevent people from being lured in by extremism?
Absolutely. So we know that former extremists actually have the most legitimacy in telling a young person why they shouldn't join an extremist group of any kind, using and curating their content so that it is deployed in ways that feel comfortable and authentic to a young person who absorbs it. So a video, an exchange where they're watching and talking with somebody who is a former extremist online, where they are learning what the bad guys do to dupe you. These are all things that we can actually spread and reshape how communities understand what the bad guys are doing and using former extremists to do it because they're the most authentic. The Against Violent Extremism Network that was built almost 15 years ago now, a network has about 300 former extremists that are part of it. Why are we not deploying their content in new ways? Why are we not working with cultural listeners and social listeners who actually market jeans and sneakers to us and help us take their content and put it in front of young people to help them understand what that us versus them ideology is doing and how it is corrupted? We haven't even thought about the kinds of ways we can bring back the narratives of former extremists who are also in the camps, the foreign fighters that have come back from ISIS, that have stories to tell, that can tell us what, in fact, the lies that ISIS told and what was the reality on the ground. We haven't taken their stories and done anything with it to actually showcase, how they've been duped. So, in fact, what we have available to us is right in front of us. But we haven't had the capacity to actually take this stuff and do anything with it.
What do we know about what lures a young person, in most cases, I think a young man, into joining a group, either online or in person, that's going to do something horrible, whatever the motivation, white supremacy, Islamic terrorism, whatever it might be? What is it that the young man gets out of that?
Listen, the most important thing to understand in terms of the system that is underlying extremism is that we no longer have our finger on the pulse of what's going on. And the young people who have grown up post 9/11 are dealing with a crisis of identity. And this issue of identity and belonging is at the core of how they are, the bad guys are able to prey upon these young people and pull them in. So when you're asking questions about what does it mean to be a real, you know, Muslim, what's the difference between culture and religion? And a group like ISIS is providing answers to those young people in ways that are culturally savvy and are generationally appropriate. They have a step up on us, and we haven't done the same thing.
We'll leave it there for now, but I hope we can talk to you again. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Farah Pandith is a foreign policy strategist and former diplomat. She's currently an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined us today to talk about the terror attacks in Sri Lanka over the weekend and anti-terror efforts around the world.